The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is John Brandt, author of Nincompoopery, Why Your Customers Hate You and How to Fix It, and you are listening to the Fabulous Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas so you can succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I'll try to point you in the right direction and save you time. This show is produced by my marketing firm. We work with manufacturers to help them grow. If you're a manufacturer and are serious about growing your business, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers, and you'll find the guide atop the organic results. And special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Ahrefs. If getting more of the right kind of traffic to your website is a priority, but doesn't seem to be happening, you need to check out Ahrefs. Ahrefs is an all-in-one SEO tool set that gives you what you need to rank your website in Google and get a lot more of the right kind of search traffic. We use it here at Artillery. Now, a subscription to Ahrefs can run in the hundreds of dollars per month, but Ahrefs is offering a 7-day trial that gives you full access to every tool, feature, and report for only $7. For details, go to ahrefs.com, spelled A-H-R-E-F-S.com. And if you get the 7-day trial, I'm going to mail you a little something special. I'll have details in a few minutes. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome John Brandt to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, Nincompoopery, Why Your Customers Hate You and How to Fix It, published by HarperCollins. John Brandt is the CEO and founder of the MPI Group, a global research firm. And before founding the MPI Group in 2003, John followed a unique career path combining two decades of experience in marketing, management, and consulting, and with a passion for journalism that has earned him more than 20 awards for reporting, writing, and editing. He was publisher and editor-in-chief of Industry Week magazine, which garnered more than 70 editorial awards for excellence and doubled its revenue under his leadership. Additionally, John served as president, publisher, and editorial director of the Chief Executive Group, publisher of Chief Executive, where his leadership transformed the magazine into one of publishing's most surprising comebacks. And, interesting fact, he was a TV weatherman once for one night. John, congratulations on Nincompoopery, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, thank you. It's good to be here. I hope it lasts longer than my TV career.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that one night, and where was it? You did this one night. It's not like you were fired.
No, I wasn't fired. It was Miles City, Montana, the 210th largest market out of 210 at the time in the United States.
Okay. Well, starting at the bottom, and I guess you decided
To leave at the bottom, yeah. Yes, but here we are.
right. So, well, listen, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and not just because of the title. I have this theory of books, and I think I'm onto something where I can predict if I'm really going to enjoy a book and if it's going to be particularly well-written. And it is, and it's 100% accurate thus far. Books written by public speakers, I mean, keynote speakers, people who make a living giving talks, and ex-journalists, I'm batting 1,000. They have all been excellent. Yours and a couple other ex-journalists that come to mind, Dory Clark and Sean Callahan, who works for LinkedIn. So it was a lot of fun to read. And we're going to talk about some of the things that just really surprised me, and I think the listener will find very interesting. But first, John Brandt, we've got to get some vocabulary out of the way. Okay? So the title of the book is Nincompoopery, Why Your Customers Hate You and How to Fix It. So I think it would be important for the listener if we could talk about what a nincompoop is. And then there's two other words that came up in the book that I think maybe you could compare and contrast. So nincompoop, a ninny, and a nitwit. Compare and contrast.
A nincompoop. Well, first of all, we're all nincompoops at some point or another. And if you don't believe me, ask a coworker, ask your spouse. Worst of all, ask your kids. They'll tell you that you're a nincompoop.
Yeah.
Nincompoopery is different. Nincompoopery is the corporate stupidity that drives everybody crazy. It's like when something goes wrong and everybody there knows it, the customer knows it, but nobody can fix it. It's like when you go to, you go to the dealership to take your car to get fixed, and you wait there, you're inconvenienced, you leave, you're driving home and you realize the car is not fixed. So then you got to go back. You got to ask them, or you got to drive an unsafe vehicle. You go back with that. And you ask them about it, and so they're going to get mad. They're going to lose profits because they got to do it over again. The mechanic is probably told that he or she is a nincompoop, and you think this is a business. You're wondering, why do they hire this person? So it's the corporate stupidity there, but it's never the nincompoops. It's always the nincompoopery. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that if that dealership, that repair shop, had like focused differently on how to train that person, how to teach them, how to think beyond just a specific task toward what their work actually meant, they would have prevented the whole thing, and everybody would have been happier. Everybody would have gotten more value. So nincompoops, nincompoopery. A ninny, that is somebody I think maybe is maybe not quite as redeemable as a nincompoop. I don't know. And a nitwit, man, you just got to stay away from a nitwit. Mm-hmm. That's what I would say to you.
Well, I've been called all three, and that's not just today, John. But the nincompoopery at the dealership is where they don't have a system that teaches the mechanic to put the lug nuts back on the wheel and then have a system to check to make sure, in fact, they're put on there. But let's go on to some other language that was just, I mean, when I saw nincompoop, I thought, God, this guy's talking to me, but maybe not. But then there were some other words that were in the book. And, you know, when you're a careful reader of these books that are on the Marketing Book Podcast and you love language as you clearly do, there were a few others. And I was wondering if these words were all pretty much the same thing or if there is some important difference. Because again, I think I may have been called all of these. And they are, it's four words. And they all end, the last part of the word is head. So there's chowderhead, dunderhead, chucklehead, and lunkhead.
I would say those are all roughly equivalent. I think you got to use it according to the audience and according to the specific offense that the person has committed. And I think that's the reader's choice.
Okay. So, but I have to wonder, like, is chowderhead better suited to people in the northeastern United States, like the Boston area where the chowder is so excellent?
I think it's going to be more suitable there than in some other areas where they might wonder exactly what a chowderhead is.
Okay.
You know, a lunkhead, that's probably going to be good anywhere. You know, I think it's your choice.
Okay. So anyway, just wanted to get that out of the way. And now I want to start with one brief excerpt from the book and get into it. This book helps leaders put a stop to nincompoopery, making their lives and those of their customers and employees immeasurably more fun and their companies measurably more profitable. What's the catch? There's only one catch, but it's big. As simple as any individual nincompoopery fixes may seem, survey your customers, hire more baristas, train the mechanic, etc., fixing an entire organization's nincompoopery problem is much harder, in part because being a leader itself, without being a nincompoop, is significantly more difficult today. That's the bad news. The good news is twofold. An anti-nincompoopery plan is ready and waiting for you and your company. And number two, you already know enough to get started. This book, which includes examples from more than 100 leaders and companies, will help with the rest. Now, John, you interviewed and studied, I guess since you started MPI, I think you said in the book, executives at more than 50,000 companies and business locations, and you looked at more than 10 million data points about corporate performance. So clearly the data and the numbers behind this. This isn't you just having a nice single malt scotch dreaming all this up. And you mentioned that over and over, the leaders of the top performing companies organize their cultures, which you explain is very important, around three deceptively simple strategies, even as their doofus competitors ignore them. What are those three deceptively simple strategies the top performing companies organize their cultures around?
When you see these companies that are doing great things, they are always focused around innovation, around talent, and around process, and figuring out how those things interact, but also doing things in vastly different ways. They tend to adopt best practices at higher rates. They just think about it differently. And it is really striking when you take a look at that.
You say these are deceptively simple strategies for three reasons. Two of them are good reasons, and one of them is a bad reason. Explain.
Well, the first one is that these are readily available to anybody of any company of any size. You know, any industry, any size. These are not something that only works in manufacturing or only works in retail or only works in healthcare. You find the same things over and over again that great companies are doing. The second part of it is that, so that's a good reason. And then the second part of it is that typically they're not expensive. I mean, they're doing this crazy old thing we used to do called thinking. And just doing things differently. They don't typically require like lots of technology, et cetera. They can, but it's really just approaching this differently. And so that's also a good thing. The third part is it's really hard. And it's really hard because you have to work hard. But even worse than that, we're human beings. And human nature makes us kind of want to fall into routines. We do the same things over and over again. And it's hard to change our ways. And people we work with or ourselves will often just fall into these routines and start thinking, well, that's just the way it is. Or even worse, we will start thinking about our customers when they give us a complaint. You know, we've all run into somebody, we've probably said it ourselves, where, customers, they're just cranky and stupid. Well, you know what? They are pretty cranky, but they're not stupid. Right. And the reason our customers are cranky, and so many of us get bad service, or frankly, a lot of us deliver bad service from our companies, is because when the customers do complain, they're not getting anything back from us. And the reason they're cranky is because the only time somebody complains to you is when they care enough about you, about the relationship, about what you're doing together, that they want you to fix it and make it better. They are giving you a gift. And most of us have organizations that are set up deliberately so that we can ignore customers and ignore the gifts that they're trying to give us. Somebody complains to you, that is the best day that you're going to have because you can build a new relationship.
So true. And that's why Jay Baer titled his book about this very specific topic, Hug Your Haters, because he talks about how when someone goes to the trouble of complaining, which is a very small minority of your customers, most of them will just leave and or tell others. But when they provide you feedback, that is a gift. That is something you should thank them profusely for if you're interested in getting valid, helpful feedback.
Absolutely. And it's 5 to 25 times more expensive to get a new customer than it is to keep somebody, even if they're mad at you.
That's right. That's right. And that's why sometimes I think what I say when I'm talking to marketing groups, I'm falling on deaf ears because I'm talking about, well, what are you doing to market to your customers? You know, that's easier sale, generally speaking, faster revenue. It's like, no, we got to get more net new customers. Like, well, okay. I think your CFO would rather just have fast revenue and more profitability right now rather than however long your sales cycle is.
And it's all about relationships. I mean, I think, yeah, but the problem is most of us are in relationships that are not with customers that are not set on like having great things happen. One of the funniest things I ever read was a number of years ago, there was a couple, they'd been married 75 years. And so the reporter goes out, troops out to them, that's a true story, and says to the husband, you know, you're in your 90s, you've been married 75 years. What is the secret to the longevity of your relationship? And the husband actually said, low expectations.
Oh.
And I thought, wow, that's really awful, but that is the way most of us, but that is the way most customer relationships are, where it's like, what's the minimum threshold? Instead of thinking, what could we do that would be great? What could we do that would make our customers' lives simpler, less stressed, make them happier? What could we do there?
Yeah.
Even if it's not related to our core product.
Absolutely. And that leads right into this. Let's talk more about this innovation. And you're very familiar with manufacturers. We work with them. And every manufacturer wants to think of themselves as innovative. And even in Bruce McDuffie's book, The New Way to Market for Manufacturing, which is an excellent book about marketing and manufacturing, he talks about, you know, innovative. But he also talks about how it's all about the product. Now, part of that is a good reason. I mean, they make a product, but they're very focused on it. But explain what you mean when you say that most people have very little understanding of what innovation actually means.
The problem with, I mean, we all love innovation. I mean, we all love apple pie. You know, everybody loves ice cream. We love innovation. The problem is we don't actually really usually think about what does innovation really mean. When most people, and especially leaders, think about innovation, they think they've got to come up with a new product or a new technology or something that's going to change. You know, you just hear all these crazy words.
Game changing,
like,
yes.
Game changing, revolutionary, awesome, incredible. And, you know, stuff like that happens. I mean, the iPhone happened. The Model T happened. The spin brush, which was the first low-cost electric toothbrush, it happened. And those really, there are stories out there. They're legend. It's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, but people also win the lottery every week, and that's even more rare.
Exactly. And the problem is that type of innovation, if you're focused on that with your company, it is the hardest one to do. And frankly, hoping for that is just hoping, to your point, to hit the lottery. 75% of companies in the United States have less than $1 million in revenue. 75%. The idea that they're going to invest what it takes to come up with a new technology. I mean, the spin brush that I talked about a minute, it took an initial investment of $1.5 million. Now it got sold for $475 million. That's a good return. But the idea that you're going to do that is just crazy. And the other problem with that is that if you're trying to time a technology or come up with a new technology, you got to get your timing exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're too early, there is no lonelier feeling than being out there trying to tell somebody that they need to buy something from you that they've never heard of and it costs a lot of money, because they've had a lot of experience with new stuff and it almost always is much more of a pain to do than they were told.
Mm-hmm.
If you're late, you might as well just not launch at all unless you have buckets of money. Because there is a first mover advantage is real. And if you're the second mover, you're going to be owed that other brand unless you are willing to spend a lot of money on it.
So what would be an example of a company or a product where the time wasn't right? And I think at one point you talked about Segway. Maybe there's another one.
Yeah, the Segway came out too early, obviously, and a lot of people couldn't figure out why they needed it. You know, Nike several years ago came out with their Fuel Band, and they came out, you know, after the Fitbit, after the Up from some other people. They had great endorsements. They put a ton of marketing into it, but because they were late to the party, they never could really crack the market share of the other folks, and they ended up laying off most of their development team several years later. And this is Nike. This is not, you know, like, you know, some mid-size or small company. It's Nike that this happened to. So the idea that you're just gonna win by coming out with a new technology is kind of crazy. I mean, I wish it for everybody. I wish it for myself. I wish it for you, Douglas. But but good luck.
Yeah.
It's much smarter to think about, okay, if we go talk to our customers, if we examine their, what could we do, as I mentioned before, even if it's not related to our core product, that would make their life simpler and that would build that relationship?
So you talk about how – well, let me back up, because you talked about – there were a couple of big points there. One was, first off, if you try and come out with that game-changing product or service innovation, it's just – it's rare to get a hit.
Right.
And then you talk about how The timing has to be absolutely right. And but the third thing you talked about, which will be of great interest to the listener, is that no matter how much you've invested in developing your revolutionary technology, you should plan on spending even more, way, way more, to launch it and market it. Oh, wait a minute. I thought if you built it, they would come.
That is my favorite theory of product marketing, the field of dreams theory. We're going to build it, and then we're just going to set it on the front lawn, and people will drive up to our office or our house and just pick it up. They are going to, you know what? That just doesn't happen. They not only will they ignore you, they will stay away in droves.
Yeah, and this is the one, of course, we run into where there's been quite a bit that's going on, and it's almost as an afterthought. It's like, oh, well, I guess we need to market it, whatever that means. There's all kinds of unasked questions, but there's this expectation, and it's often, you know, some brilliantly designed engineered product or whatever, and they're like, oh, they're disappointed that they actually have to stoop to marketing it.
That they actually have to go out and talk to human beings and convince them that this would be a good idea. Yes, that always seems like a pain, but yes, that is required.
So, as it relates to innovation, talk about what happens when innovation really does win. Okay, so we're clearly saying it's not about so much about the product, but it's more about the ability to make your customer's life easier, not that shiny new widget.
It absolutely is. And that's kind of the outcome there. You know, when you think about innovation, it is doing things in new ways. It doesn't mean new products. And what this really requires is going out and visiting customers, living with them. And it means you're not taking them to a game or for dinner or whatever. You're going in their house.
Yes.
Or you're going in their business, and you're working side by side with them and asking, you know, what is the problem? And it can be really small things. You know, in a manufacturing context, you know, you might, you know, I remember covering one firm where at Industry Week where they just would go out and meet with people, and they would find stuff out like, you know, when you send the parts over, if you could pack them differently, it would make it easier for us to unload them. That has nothing to do with the product itself, but it did two things. One, it made the customer more productive, and two, they were sending out frontline employees to talk to frontline employees.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is that you're building a relationship there where there's the camaraderie, there's the team building, but there's also the understanding what is actually happening at the Gemba, what is happening at the front lines of work. And what we see people doing is that when you do that, you kind of want to look and several different areas, you know, because I mentioned in the book, I've got a friend who runs an ad agency, and he said years ago that he had determined that the secret to all professional marketing of all professional services was five words: me smart, make you rich.
Okay.
And so I think the new customer mantra is me smart, make you less stressed, whether it's a consumer or whether it's a business person. How well do you understand that customer? Do you have a program where everybody in your firm goes out and works with customers? There are so many companies that have vast customer-free zones, you know, the boardroom, you know, where it's like where people are like, oh, customers. I met a customer once, and man, they're crazy. They want stuff, and they want it on time. Can you believe that?
Yes, and it's like you're reading my notes here, because the next question was, explain what a customer-free zone is. Yet another thing I'm stealing from your book. And you talk about this customer-free zone where nobody is – really in contact with customers. They don't feel like what they do affects the customer. And maybe they're the ones most likely to think the customer is stupid. So that was terrific. And there have been a few other books on the podcast that talk about what you're talking about, but frankly, there's not enough discussion of this. And that is, you've got to go and spend time with your customers, and you have to observe them, not just what they're saying. Stop. You know, yeah, surveys are nice, but go visit with them. And maybe not even, I think a lot of companies may turn to the sales team and say, well, what are the customers saying? You need to do more than that. And there was another book on the podcast called Small Data by Martin Lindstrom, where he talked about this exact same thing. And he gave examples of companies that have been very successful. And the CEOs have said every employee is going to go spend 24 hours with a customer, yep. And in this case, this one particular company, at their homes, because it was a product that was sold in the home.
Absolutely.
He saw that work so well. It's more like ethnography than research, but that's where you're just there and you're observing them and you start to pick up these things. And it's funny because we'll get a new client and we'll go off. And one of the things we do is we go interview their customers and do some buyer persona research. And we come back and one thing they'll say is, boy, you really understood our customers. Well, the fact is they were just a few questions we had to ask to probe for. But the other thing that they say is, gosh, you know, there's a whole lot that goes on in our customers' world before they finally reach out to us. You think?
And it's like, really? Are they not thinking about us all the time? Is that true?
Yes. Wow. Yes. So it's, oh boy. It's, you know, it's easy to kind of explain it here, like us talking about it. But, you know, as David C. Baker said in his book, The Business of Expertise, it's hard to read the label when you're inside the jar.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're going to take a break here so I can tell you more about Ahrefs and a really sweet offer they have. If getting more of the right kind of traffic to your website is a priority, but it doesn't seem to be happening, you owe it to your business and your career to check out Ahrefs. It's okay. You can thank me later. Ahrefs is an all-in-one SEO toolset that gives you the information you need to rank your website in Google and get tons of the right kind of search traffic. We use it here at Artillery. A few of my favorite tools are Site Audit. It crawls your entire website and gives a comprehensive report on any issues that may be hurting your SEO performance. You're going to be surprised and maybe a little embarrassed at what the Site Audit is going to find. If you're a marketer responsible for your website, you'll want to run this report before your boss does. And if you're an agency responsible for your client's website, you better run this report before your clients do. Another tool that's really cool is Site Explorer. This is where you can research any website, but especially your competitors. One popular way to use this is to figure out your competitors' marketing strategies by studying the keywords they rank for in search results and finding out the pages that bring them the most traffic from search. You can research anything from like how fast their search traffic is growing to which websites are linking to them to the pages on their website with the most backlinks. And another cool tool is Keyword Explorer. This is a great tool to have before you create more content for your site. It helps you discover thousands of great keyword ideas, gauge how difficult it is to rank for them, and calculate their traffic potential. You can also find out what your potential customers are searching for online to help make sure that you're including the right keywords and content on your site. Now, a monthly subscription to Ahrefs can run in the hundreds of dollars, but Ahrefs is offering a 7-day trial that gives you full access to every tool, feature, and report for only $7. So even if you don't end up subscribing, the reports that you can run are a phenomenal value. Seriously. Otherwise, if you've got money coming out the wazoo, hire an SEO firm and give them a king's ransom. But don't be upset when you find out they're using Ahrefs to run the same reports that you can run. Also, just a bit of medical advice. If you've got money coming out the wazoo, you should probably get that checked. Now, are there other all-in-one SEO tools? Sure there are, and they're good. But in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, there's a link to an article about the 9 most important features that Ahrefs has that no other SEO tool does. Check that out. To get the 7-day trial for just $7, visit ahrefs.com. And that's spelled Ahrefs.com. But wait, when you get that 7-day trial, I want you to forward your confirmation email to me at douglas@salesartillery.com, include your mailing address, and I will mail you, wherever you are in the world, a Marketing Book Podcast bookmark and a laptop sticker and even a little thank you note just for you. And even if you don't want me to send you anything, send me the email anyway so I can show Ahrefs how smart they were to support the Marketing Book Podcast, because otherwise they're not going to know I sent you. So help a brother out, yo. And now back to the show. So it's, you know, there's one other thing in here that just jumped off the page, which was it's imperative that we think creatively about what our customers really want from us, because it's often not what we imagine. Give an example of that.
it's really interesting when you look at some of the cooler business stories of the last decade or so. There's a company in China. It's called JD.com. It used to be known as 360buy.com. And they were an electronics retailer. And right during the big global downturn, they decided to change their business model and invest heavily. And if you would ask you or me or anybody else, we probably wouldn't have wanted to invest. That was when Circuit City was going under, et cetera. But they did something really interesting. They set up a program where, yes, they went online, but what they did was they said, okay, look, if you order from us in cities in China where they were, if you order from us by 11 a.m., your TV, your stereo, your router, your computer, whatever it is, we will have it delivered, installed, and working by 6 p.m. If you miss the 11 a.m. deadline, but you call us by 6, we'll have it in your house by 11 a.m. the next day. And it sounds crazy. And then also, by the way, and if something doesn't work and we've already left, we have a 100-minute guarantee. We will be back within 100 minutes to fix that. And they killed it. They went from millions of dollars to billions of dollars of revenue. And why does that work? Well, what's different? Well, what's different about it is it's not so much they went online. A lot of people went online. What they did is they figured out that customers didn't actually want – when you go to a store to buy a computer, a TV, you don't want to buy a computer. You don't want to buy a TV. What you want to do is surf the web. What you want to do is watch TV. You want to listen to music. There's a thing you want. You don't really care about the product itself.
Yeah, they are in the business of delivering entertainment.
Right. So they what they figured out was that it wasn't so much the product itself. That's what they're still going to get paid for. But what you're really buying from them is the idea of enjoying that product. And so what they did is they made that seamless and figured out how to do that. And they were rewarded with massive, massive growth. I mean, they've done lots of other things well as well. But that was the thing that was really striking about that model. And that's what I'm talking about, is that we got to stop, we got to get away from thinking it's the product itself. I mean, I think I've mentioned before that, you know, it's about 10, 20 years ago, the biggest scam ever perpetrated on customers came out. It was called ISO 9000.
Yes.
We promised everybody. All of a sudden, everybody in the world just stood up and said, you know what? We're going to promise that what we sell you is quality.
Yeah, you said that this is this, and, you know, I know the manufacturers, their ears are perking up. Plus, you're in the Cleveland area, so they're, you know, you could swing absolutely a dead cat and hit a manufacturer. So, you talked about total quality management, TQM, ISO 9000, but what's interesting is you said that is one of the greatest marketing scams ever perpetuated upon unsuspecting customers.
It's because, you know, shouldn't the stuff just have worked anyway? Why do you get to advertise to me that what you sold me is what you told me you sold me? What customers want to do is imagine the product is like a thing. You're just looking at it, whatever it is. What customers want now is what are you wrapping around that?
Yes.
What value do you bring to the relationship? What other things can you do? You know, do you have some sort of, you know, in a manufacturing context, we'll just talk about that. You know, we've got stats that depending on how you ask the question, it's anywhere from, you know, 67% to over 80% of manufacturers in the U.S. are using lean in some way or another. When you actually sort out, are they really doing it? That's another question. But anyway, they're doing lean, which means that you're doing just in time. Well, if you're doing just in time, then the quality of delivery from a supplier might be even more important than the product quality.
Mm-hmm.
And if you miss a delivery, they are not going to forget you, but not in the way you hoped. You know, people want to know, what can you do beyond this? You know, and for a big company, it can be co-manage inventory. It can be research on markets. For a small company, it might be, we have a great safety program. Can we share it with you? You know, we found this really good way to hire, because I know you're having trouble hiring just like we are. Can we help you with that?
Yes.
How do you build relationships so that, because what you want to do is get away from a transactional relationship where it's only about price and where somebody looks at it and says, okay, whatever the price is, we're getting so much value elsewhere, we can't imagine disturbing this relationship.
Right. And it's not necessarily about your product, but it's still something that you can help your customer with. You can cut their to-do list in half, as I think you mentioned there. But let's talk about that. You mentioned recruiting. One of the three big points here is talent. And what are some of the most important things companies need to remember about the talent, their workforce? For instance, you talk about training matters, but culture matters more. But what are some of the most important things companies need to understand about talent and where are they kind of blowing it?
Well, we see lots of companies blowing it everywhere, to your point, in that, you know, we have a lot of really good euphemistic language that lots of companies use. There are great mission statements, our workforce, our workforce, our workers are our most valuable asset. You know, our most valuable assets walk out the door each day. Or my favorite, associates, or these are our partners. Our employees are our partners. Mm-hmm. The problem is when you go to most companies and ask how do you really treat a partner? If you were running a business and somebody was really your partner, or maybe your partner in life, I don't know, you would share information, you would share decision making, and you would share the rewards of your success together. Most companies don't do that, or they don't do it really, really well. And I mean, there's some stats out there. I think there's some huge number of companies, like 76% of private companies, don't share financials, you know, with their employees.
Right. You and know, I think, and was just, it that same number, or 85% of employees, according to Gallup, are not engaged not, in their work?
Many places you go, you can imagine. And then, but if you look at their lives, you would be like, why would you be engaged? You're not treated well. Mm-hmm. So,
and then they don't trust you. They're doing things that make you feel not trusted. Like the example you had of that one place where they had to sign out the tools that they needed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So talk about the training. I found it interesting that you did, based on all the data that you all combed through, that some of the better companies were spending at least 40 hours a year on training for employees. And somehow I thought that it would have been a higher number.
Well, 40 hours, I would say, is the minimum if you want to try to be world-class. When you look at award-winning companies, really great companies, they're doing 60, 70, 100 hours or more of training. However, the vast majority of companies we look at are doing 8 hours of training a year, mm-hmm. you know, a few more than that. And it's just, it's not helpful. And we've done benchmark studies of performance in industries ranging from heavy industry to beauty salons to pest control to healthcare to and you know, when we look at all this data, we always go to, okay, what are the correlations? What are the things? Because we don't just look at benchmarks. We also ask about best practices, and we want to figure, because what we want to do is not just say, well, you're really great, or you really stink at that. We want to say, okay, what's the ladder? You know, if you're not good, what are the things that the better companies are doing that you should do if you want to be like them? Mm-hmm. And in every single study we've done, there are two things that correlate with better performance over the long term. And the number one is, how much do you train? How much training do you provide annually per employee? The more you train, the better you perform. And the really interesting thing too, in a number of studies we looked at, is you would think then, so they must be spending a higher percentage of their revenues on training. It's about the same percentage of revenue. It's just you have more revenue, so you're spending a little more on the training. And I think more revenue is generally a good thing. The second biggest correlation is what percentage of your workforce is in self-directed or empowered work teams. And the reason that's important is because when you look at developed economies, there really isn't a model out there that works for how to organize yourself or organize your company that isn't decentralized, that doesn't put decision-making really close to the front line of work or to customers. Hierarchical organizations, command and control, you really only find successful organizations like that with organizations that have to deploy force, whether it's the police or military, et cetera. Every other place in a developed economy, it's got to be decentralized. And so that this correlates with what I'm talking about. That, so if you're going to perform better, then you got to have people who are really smart that you've trained a lot, and you've got to have people who have a lot of ability to make decisions for customers. I tell a story in the book. I was at a conference one time giving a talk, and this person, and it was a group of smaller companies. A guy in the back pops up. I was talking about the importance of training. He goes, "Well, let me tell you the story." He goes, "We tried that training thing. We tried that training thing, and what we found was that every time somebody got good, somebody else hired them away. So what we realized is we can't afford to train." And I just stood there because I'm like their guest. I'm like, what do I say to this guy? And it was a really lively group. This other CEO popped up, and she popped up, looked at the guy and said, "Well, I have to tell you, that is about the best employee retention strategy I have ever heard. Keep them so ignorant that nobody wants to hire them."
Right, right. And I loved that story, and it brought to mind a former client of ours from back when we were more in the ad game, but an HVAC company. I'm still a customer of theirs, actually. Terrific group. And they train their employees. They were on the Inc. 5000. I mean, these guys are really squared away. And they train employees every day. There's a certain amount of new tech that they have to understand, and they're just training, and they're training how to deal with homeowners, all that sort of thing. Well, some of their competitors have, you know, they all these owners, they get together every once in a while, and they said, you know, why do you spend so much time and money on training? What happens if you train these people and they leave? And his response was, what happens if they stay?
Exactly, exactly.
And guess what? They stay.
If they stay, you're stuck with them.
Right, right.
Until you fix it, and that's not fun.
No. So let me just read the beginning of chapter 4. It's all about process, okay? So we've talked about innovation, we've talked about talent, now we're going to talk about process. So your chapter is titled Process. Hey, let's talk process. Wait, where are you going? Come back. John Brandt, why is process considered to be the spinach or broccoli or Brussels sprouts, which I really hate? Why is it those things of the strategy world?
It's that of the strategy world because it doesn't look as fun as the other stuff. I mean, who doesn't like to be innovative, right? Who doesn't want to be known as the innovator when you go to the cocktail party or the industry conference? And, you know, and that's like fun. We're going to sit around. We're going to think of new stuff. Wow, how cool is that? Or talent. It's like, okay, we're going to try to find really smart, nice people to work with us. And oh my gosh, that's pretty awesome too. I like having coffee with them. It's fun to work with them. That's all great. But process, you know, process is hard work. You're going to have to take a look at stuff, and you're going to have to confront the stuff that you and your peers have been doing badly for a while and fix it. The issue is, the reason it's so important is that where you start making all your money from all the great stuff you did with innovation and with talent is when you start taking a look at your processes and figuring out, how do we make this work for our customers at a margin that is appropriate for us? A lot of people just want to ignore it because, I mean, it's hard. I mean, as human beings, we're really good at ignoring hard work, right?
Just
take a look at your basement, you know? So
not only are you reading my notes, but you've actually been in my house. Yeah, it's not just the basement, friend. But anyway, yeah, you know, we've been living there since 97 in this house, our first and only house. We moved out of Manhattan and moved into this house. And I remember saying to my wife, you know, I think every 5 years we should move. And what I meant was, we're not going to move the house, but we're going to hire a moving company every 5 years, load the house up, which is then going to force us to get rid of all the clutter and stuff that we don't need, and then, you know, move in and unpack.
I think that's a fabulous idea. That is a wonderful Kaizen event for you.
Right. Yeah, kind of a shock to the heart. But talk a bit more about how process does actually deliver or kill customer value.
It's really important to do this right, because you can have the greatest innovation. You could have figured out what the customers need, et cetera. You could have figured out, okay, we got the right people to deliver it. But if your processes are structured incorrectly, you're not going to be able to deliver it efficiently. And one of two things, or maybe both, are going to happen. One, you're not going to deliver the value, or you're not going to make any money delivering it, or you're going to do the worst of all worlds, is just you're going to really irritate customers and lose money, which is just, you know, that's sort of the that's the hat trick of idiotic processes.
Right. Irritate customers and lose money.
It's just
if you're going to do it, you know, go all the way.
Go all the way. So the first thing that I always encourage people to do is take a look at your organization, but take a look at it with a different way. You want to look at, what are the sort of the broad processes where we're delivering value to customers? Because most of us have companies, and, you know, if I go to somebody and say, show us how your company's organized, they're going to give us this big chart. There's going to be executive vice presidents and, you know, charts and, you know, matrixed reporting, etc. And that's not going to, if I'm a customer, if I look at the titles of most of those people, I am not going to have a clue how that person actually affects me. What I want people to do is take a look at, okay, if you're looking at a company, what are these broad areas? And those we think there are seven of them: research and development, procurement, administration, logistics, sales and marketing, production and performance, service and support. It is unimportant whether anybody agrees with me or not, because some people are going to say, ah, we're different. We only have five. Or some people are going to say, oh my gosh, we got eight. You know, if you tell me you got 30, I'm going to disagree with you. But reasonable people can disagree about this. But the reason it's important is because you want to look at your company through your customer's eyes. I mean, I would encourage you even to think about doing a transaction and walking through a transaction with your company as if you were not part of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And see what happens when you do that. Because when you start doing this, and then when you start doing some value stream mapping, so mapping these actual processes and trying to figure out how well do we do this? How well do we compare with our competitors on this? What you start finding is all kinds of wastes, all kinds of gaps in there where you're irritating people, you're making them rekey their data. You're making them, I mean, how many times have you gone to a website to buy something and you have to enter the same data three times?
Mm-hmm. Not Amazon.
Not Amazon. Not Amazon. But there's all kinds of processes like that. Why do we make it hard for people to give us money? Why do we make it hard? I mean, that is the thing that just drives me crazy. I'm like, I refuse. Why does a company make it hard for me to give them money? They should like send somebody to my house to pick up the money. That's what they should do.
Right. Now that point about the different departments, let's say there's seven or five main areas though. Say more about that, because you have to look at each one of them and figure out, well, how are we helping the customer?
Right.
In other words, every one of those should not be a customer-free zone. So what would be an example of one of those departments that maybe some companies think is not customer-focused, and instead what should they be focused on? I mean, what would be one like accounting maybe?
Accounting, procurement, administration. You're going to have tons of people at many companies there who have never seen a customer.
Mm-hmm.
They're just customers are like Yetis. You know, it's like, I thought I saw one in the conference room, but I'm not sure. I've never seen one before. And in that situation, that's another reason to have, you know, I always encourage corporate leaders to have everybody go and meet a customer. I said, because, you know, the worst thing that happens is they'll go out and find out, oh my gosh, your job is really hard. You have to deal with these customers. But we hope that what really happens is they go, oh, and then having them make that connection between what they're doing in accounting. I mean, what we've seen in a number of industries is that as process has improved, whether you're using Lean, Six Sigma, TQM, whatever, it typically would start in a processing area, whether it's forms or a production area. Companies are now seeing that they need to do this across the entire company.
Yes.
Because there's waste everywhere. You know, you look at there's like lots of companies now where everything related to invoicing is still paper.
Mm-hmm.
And
how does that help the customer?
How does that help the customer? The customer just wants stuff. They'd be happy to pay you electronically, but you're still sending them a paper invoice and then asking that they send it back.
Right. That's right.
Because you didn't ask them if that's what they wanted to do. That's just how you do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, John Brandt, if avoiding nincompoopery is so simple, why isn't everyone doing it?
We are not avoiding nincompoopery for lots of reasons. Much of it human nature, because we just get used to it. But mainly we sabotage ourselves. Because what happens is anytime nincompoopery is occurring, you know, it's mainly, I blame mainly the leaders because they should take the goal. I mean, I don't let employees or everybody else off the hook because, you know, they could complain. They could try to fix something. They could quit. But it's the leaders. But what happens, though, is that a lot of times people who should lead a change, are in position to lead a change, don't do it. And why don't they do it? Well, they don't do it because they get stuck in their routines, that's the traditional ways. But a lot of times it's because they don't believe anybody's going to listen to them. And we've all got, you know,
so you're talking about not the CEO. You could be talking about the head of marketing or the head of sales.
I'm talking about head of marketing. I'm talking about head of a production team. Okay. I'm talking about, you know, somebody who's and individual employees. I mm-hmm. think it's everybody's responsibility. And we all have so many voices in our heads, right? Telling us, oh my gosh, nobody's going to listen to you. We got the voices of the people around us. You know, there's the woe is change thing.
Right.
Like, oh, nothing will ever happen. Oh, nobody could ever fix this. Then there's the woe is you group. Which is, you know, oh, what do you know? You've only been here 10 years. How
uh-huh.
could you? You know, da 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 da. And then there's the woe is everything, which is just, you know, they've given up. So The problem is if we listen to them, and often we, whether we are intentionally listening to them or not, often we listen to them. And then we also have the voices in our own head saying, oh my gosh, well, you know, I remember all my screw ups. And what people forget is that when you make mistakes over your career, it doesn't disqualify you from leadership. It qualifies you for leadership.
Right. Battle scars.
You know what? There's stove. After you touch that stove one time, as a good friend of mine says, I ask him about something. He goes, stove hot, no touch stove anymore. Right. And that's the thing. But we get stuck in thinking about who we were maybe 5 years ago. I believe a lot of it ends up, when people are not confident, it ends up being a matter of lagging self-perception. And what I mean by that is that we all live in our own heads, even if we're living with other people. We tend to think of ourselves as what we were 5, 10, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times we don't see the real person in the mirror. We actually don't see the same person other people see. And they see somebody who's da-da-da-da, and we're still thinking, oh my gosh, I wonder if they find it. What if they find out about the Smith deal? Because I kind of screwed up on that one.
Yeah. Well, they remember, but probably everyone else doesn't. But the end of the book was so interesting because it was very inspiring, but it also talks to the head trash that so many people have and why they shouldn't have it. And they're actually probably in a better position to start taking action. But the other thing about the end of the book that was so interesting to me was, because it was one of my favorite topics, change and why humans are so afraid of it and why they react to change the way they do. And you, again, boiled it down to like three things that are so important. I was wondering if you could talk about them, that being security, relationships, and meaning. What do those three words have to do with implementing change in a company?
Well, it's a great question because I think one of the things that we sometimes get confused about is we become very task oriented. You know, we think, well, we got to do this change. We got to fix this. We got to fix that. We got to put in this new technology. We're going to have to change this, move this around here. Got to reorganize. All of that is really important. The problem is that that's half or less of what really matters in a change effort, because the other half is the human component.
Mm. And what's more complicated than humans?
Yes, absolutely. Paul Lawrence wrote, you know, a long time ago that when there's change in a business, it's usually not technical change that people are resistant to. Mm-hmm. They become resistant to, how does this change my relationships, my social status, etc.? How does it change? And when you look at it, what it really boils down to, anytime you are asking a group to change, it's not just that they have to do things differently. It's that you are affecting several really core primal needs.
Yes.
Security, which is, am I safe? But safe is not just, am I physically safe? Is, am I economically safe? Am mm-hmm. I going to be secure? What happens to my job if we make this change? Next is relationships. And the relationships are, well, how will this change the people I work with? But more importantly, I think, at some level, is how will this change my status at work? How will people think about me here, at home, in the community? What does it mean? Will I lose face? Will I lose status? Will I lose friendships? Mm-hmm. And the third thing is meaning. And because once our needs as human beings for security, depending on whatever rubric you want to look at, it's security and relationships. Once we feel secure with those, we tend to always turn toward meaning. And for most people, the primary meaning in their life will come from some combination of family, values, faith, etc. But there's a secondary meaning, because all of us are going to spend, if you do the math, if you're going to work for 40 or 50 years, if you're going to spend roughly a third of your work week at work, it adds up to 90,000 hours or more. And if you're going to, and most of us at some point, consciously or unconsciously, you're like, we'd like that 90,000 hours, those 90,000 hours to mean something more than just time served. We'd like it to do something, to feel good about that, to feel mm-hmm. like we've changed something for the better. So when you're managing a change, you have to think of those three things. Weirdly enough, you have to do them in reverse order, even though, because you can't start with security, because typically when you're making a change, it's because something's burning down and you got to fix it now, and you're not going to be able to guarantee economic security. So what you got to do is start with meaning. You're going to have to, you know, whether and meaning, I'm not saying go up on top of a mountain and give a speech or hand out books of poetry, but you got to talk to people about, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is why it's important to customers. This is why it's going to make things better for them and for you. So you're going to address meaning first. Then you're going to say, talk about, and show empathy for and talk about, it's going to change the way we work together. You know, but and you're going to have, you know, real empathy, not apathy toward the way people feel. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you're going to have to say, probably a lot of times you're not being able to say we can guarantee security now, but if we do this and it works the way we think it will, we are going to create economic security for the organization and for ourselves going forward. And it's really important. Where a lot of change goes wrong, where a lot of resistance pops up, is when people try to hurry people through the human part. And it's really easy to do that, right? Because if something's going bad and you got to fix it, it's like it's really easy to just think that, you know, go into firefighting mode and you're going to put on your helmet, you're going to jump in and give orders. I mean, you know, it's a very heroic image of what a leader is. That's not really what leaders do. Really great leaders will do that, obviously. I mean, if there's an emergency that's burning down, yes. But what real leaders do is they figure out, how are we going to manage that human component so that everybody on the team can get there if they're willing to work hard?
Yes. And, you know, this brought to mind companies that some enormous number of companies have tried to implement CRMs that have failed. And I'm starting to think, well, maybe it wasn't the CRM. People are very threatened by whatever this tool is. And there's, of course, you know, there's so many marketing tools, thousands and thousands of them. And people think, oh, let's just implement this new tool. But actually, I saw something the other day that said, you know, never buy a tool unless it's already wrapped in a process. Yes. And it brought me back to the conclusion of your book, talking about how, you know, it's not really the tool. And also sometimes companies think that they can implement change simply with a tool, when actually there's this whole human component. It was so nicely boiled down to security, relationships, and meaning that you outline towards the end of the book. So, John, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
My hope would be that they would recognize that they already know pretty much what they need to know to do change. I mean, if the book helps, great. If another book helps, great. Anything helps, great. I think there's so much nincompoopery out there. We all experience it. We all, frankly, sometimes deliver it to our customers. That you can fix this. It doesn't cost a lot of money. You just have to think different. You have to do that crazy. You have to do that crazy old fashioned thing called thinking.
Yeah, which I hate to do. Yeah,
you might have to get off the electronics for an hour a day, and just actually think about, how could things be different? What could we do that would be different and great? And then work hard and make sure that you're managing that human element. That is the one thing I would hope, because I get frustrated sometimes you'll hear some grandiose theory of how companies need to do this, or, you know, there's a lot of what I would call entrepreneurial and managerial porn out there. A lot of it meaning workshops where they, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, where it's very light. It makes you feel, it's like, it makes you feel good for a day. It doesn't really help you. What really happens, what really needs to be done, is rethinking differently. You're not going to get it out of going to a workshop. You're not going to get it out of doing one thing. You're going to get it out of living with your customers, getting the best team around you, and working hard on your processes.
Well said.
This is available to everybody.
Yes, and one of the, you know, everybody reads a book differently, but one of the takeaways is that I had from the book was, you've got what you need. Stop looking for one more book, or, you know, stop looking for the perfect putter for all you golfers. You've got what you need. And stop telling yourself that you're not capable of making this change. There was such a funny story you tell in the book about how you were at Industry Week, and pretty rather quickly you became the editor-in-chief. And there was some executive who came in and said, everyone... And things were not going well. And you were thinking, gosh, maybe I should have been doing this longer, but suddenly here I am. And some executive came in and said, everybody here thinks they can do a better job than you can. But what was, years later, what was it you finally realized that guy was telling you?
I will tell you, that was a little disconcerting at that moment. I got this silver-haired executive vice president in a good-looking suit coming, just so you know, everybody in this building thinks they can do a better job than you. I'm like, well thanks for that, because I probably agree with them. So
yeah, at the time.
At the time. What I realized later was that he wasn't making a joke or taunting me. He was basically telling me, look, this place hasn't been doing well. Everybody's got an idea. He was kind of giving me permission to do something new.
Which you did.
It was a gift. It was a gift. Well, what a whole bunch of us did. It wasn't just me.
That's right. That's right.
There was a whole team that worked together, and it worked. And it was some of the most fun I ever had. It was exhausting because it's really hard. It's really hard work. It's really hard work to think and do things differently.
Right. But if you had been listening to more of that head trash,
yep,
you would have never done it.
Absolutely.
But you just let it go and started taking action, and there you go. So, John, what books have inspired your work and career?
There have been so many of them, so it's hard to know, hard to narrow it down. There are two that really strike me. It might be a little odd. One of them is Getting to Yes by Roger Fisher, mm-hmm. which has been out there for 10,000 years. But what really was wonderful about that book is it really taught me a new vocabulary at the time. I read it many, many years ago. It taught me a new vocabulary for how to deal with disagreements with other people. It's not just about negotiation. It's about, okay, we live in a very big world and people want different things and think differently. How do we work together in that way? And I think the other one would be The Elephant and the Flea by Charles Handy, which is really interesting and was prescient about how the economy would change. He put out the idea of a portfolio career before most people were talking about it, is that the idea of having a job or only a job or one job for your life was just going away. And it was really inspiring, that view of the future, but it was also the idea that we needed to rethink, I believe, what economic security is for ourselves, for our kids, for the people we work with. Economic security is not necessarily, you know, the job you have or the salary or the retirement. It is what you learn. It is mm-hmm. what you know and what you can carry on to the rest of your life. And not just in technical skills, but in emotional intelligence, et cetera. And so I'd say those are two of the ones that really influenced me pretty deeply.
We'll include links to your sites, your LinkedIn profile, and all the books that we've both mentioned on this episode, show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, so that listeners can find all that. And I would hope they'll reach out to you and thank you for being a guest. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found right now by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Nincompoopery, Why Your Customers Hate You and How to Fix It. The author is John Brandt. John, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, thanks for having me.
And that closes the book on episode 238 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Hrefs. To start getting more of the right kind of traffic to your website, start your 7-day trial for just $7 by visiting hrefs.com, spelled Ahrefs.com. And don't forget to let Dougie Fresh know about it. And please join us next time as we welcome Ethan Butte to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the new book he has authored with Stephen Pacinelli, Rehumanize Your Business, How Personal Videos Accelerate Sales and Improve Customer Experience. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Amanda Harrison. All right.
Yeah, my kids are like, Dad, why do you laugh at your own jokes? I go, well, I'm funny. Why wouldn't I laugh at them?
Yes. Oh, I'm the king of the dad jokes. And
how old are yours?
They're 24 and 21.
All right, I got 26 and 22.
Oh, okay. So when Emma, they both had the same kindergarten teacher. So at the end of Emma's kindergarten year, you know, went in with my wife to the parent teacher thing. Very nice teacher. And at one point, you know, she said that Emma did great and all that. And then at one point, she said, you know, I had both your children in my class, and they both got every joke I ever told. And I wanted to drop the mic and say, my work is done here.
My work is done.
Yes.
I had a similar, my son was, we went for the conference at age six, and along with whatever else they or he was like six or seven, and the teacher said, I just want to tell you, he sometimes says stuff and I have to leave the room. He goes, the other kids don't get it. Same thing.
Well
same
done, thing. John Brandt. Yes.
And I could not have been prouder. I was like,
yes. Oh, yes. Gosh. Yes. Okay. So we are cut from the same cloth.